And it is not necessary that we have to pick up some particular work. Also, it is not necessary that it has to happen all of a sudden. One has to take a gradual course, that slowly the actions get transformed. It is not easy to transform our nature that is attached to the world. If we are told that do the work unselfishly, do the work without any attachment, else don't do, then we will end up not doing anything. It is not possible for us to do the work in a desireless and unattached way right in the beginning. It is very well understood by the sages that human psyche is like that. We have to give some incentives, that kind of tempting objects, carrot and sticks are to be used to make people work. We don't like this, but the fact is to be faced that most of us work like slaves here. Like the slaves, they have to be shown that, well, if you do this work, this is the carrot, you know, you will get this. If you don't, here is the stick. So like that the people are accustomed to work. We call ourselves free, that I am the citizen of a free country. I choose what I have to do. Do we really make choice? It is, if we look deeper, we will see that it is not so. So many things, they govern our choices. It is give a little promise that yes, if you do such and such thing, here is a reward for you, then we go for it. So that is how we are accustomed to work. If suddenly we hear the message of Lord Krishna, do work without attachment, we don't know how to do it. We do not know how this can happen. It can happen, but somehow the correlation has taken place like that because of habit. Like we had a typist, and I asked him one day, that I was not remembering exactly the spelling of some word, and I asked him whether it is is it single L or double L, and he could not immediately tell. What he did was he moved his fingers, you know, when he types the words, he moves those fingers accordingly, and looking at the fingers, that yes, he said it is double L, because I pressed the finger twice for L. Like that he could tell. Now, actually the spelling doesn't depend on the fingers. But for him, those two things are connected. If you tie his hands and ask him the spellings, he will not be able to tell. Like many, though especially the Indian classical musicians and all, they do lot of hand movements and all that, head movement, whatever, while singing. Now, it is, why do they do that? It is a question of, you know, correlation. That when the voice is, say, going up, they will show it by hand like that. Not that the hand is producing the voice. But if their hands are tied, they will not be able to sing, you know, because it is the correlation has been established. If they practice it, yes, if they understand that this is not, that hand is not producing your voice, it is giving you an indication, that's all. So we are like that, connected with our selfish interests and works. That something gives me this, and therefore I do it. Actually, that is how we are not able to do our work in a detached fashion. That is why the question always gets asked. And it is throughout I have seen that whenever the question of learning to work in a detached manner comes up, people ask this question, how is work then possible at all? If I am told to work in a detached manner, the work is not possible. I know I work because I get something out of it. If not, then I will not go to work at all. It is not possible to work without a desire propelling us. But really, that is like the spelling is not possible unless you move the hands. And unless you move the fingers in a particular way, that boy could not tell the spelling. And he himself laughed at it when he started doing this. And, hey, why these hands? And then he laughed at it. Well, that is how the spellings come to me. It is with all of us, certain actions are associated with certain other actions. The association is kind of arbitrary, formed out of habit. It has no correlation as such. There is no internal connection between the two. We are habituated to do things like that. And like you all know that Pavlov's dog story, that there is the connection that he was giving him food. He was giving his dog food, and at that time the bell would ring. Now that bell and the food got connected in the dog's psyche. And thus what happened? Even without the food, they ring the bell and the saliva would start dripping from the dog. Why so? The correlation was there. So the dog wouldn't get that feeling of food without that bell being rung. The food is there, but unless the bell is rung, it doesn't come. In our monasteries also, where there are big monasteries, to call everybody for the lunch hour, a big bell is there in most of our big centers. They have big. Here there is a very small place, so we don't have any such thing. But a bell is rung for breakfast and for lunch and all that. And then everybody turns then towards the dining room. If the bell is not rung, then your taste buds and the hunger, that doesn't get awakened at all. The bell is important. Unless the bell is rung, you cannot eat properly, because the correlation has been formed like that. So, similarly, our actions and our that attachment, they have formed a kind of stranglehold on us, that we are not able to act, we are not able to exercise our freedom in our actions. It is the desires and attachments. We first feel that I am choosing to do like this. Later on we will see that we are not really choosing, we are compelled to do that. Our attachments are compelling us to do that. It is, even if we try, it is difficult for us to withdraw from it. Freedom means if we have the freedom to withdraw from it. Do we have that freedom to withdraw? Just see. It is so difficult. And that is what colors our whole life. So, the process we saw, gradually Lord Krishna told Arjuna that you can start, begin this, you know, learn first to give for what you get. It is that sense of giving will come, and then you can proceed from there, that whole ladder of progress. Like ladder has steps. If you are asked to jump on the top of a, say, 50-foot building, you will not be able to that jump 50 feet. Then if the choice is staying on the ground or taking a leap 50 feet high, we will all end up being on the ground. But there is the ladder. We can put the ladder, one rung after another rung, then we climb, and thus we get to the top. So, like that, this ladder is provided, the ladder of gradually learning the technique of unselfish work. And this unselfish work is not meant for doing good to the world. We try to do good to the world, but in the end, actually, it helps us. There is no definition for good to the world. Everybody has different idea about good to the world. In Swami Vivekananda's beautiful book, Karma Yoga, Yoga of Action, there is a chapter, we help ourselves in helping the world. There is the helping the world is really not possible because we do not know what the world requires. We have our ideas, this is good for the world. And no two people have exactly same ideas about what is good to the world. Vishwanath's idea about good to the world will be against the Sam's idea of good to the world. Now, what is good to the world then? The child's idea is, well, make the world full of chocolates. And then some grown-ups also have similar ideas, let there be lot of chocolates. What that song is, was there, lots of chocolates for me to eat. That was the idea of the happiness there. The world is very nice if it has enough chocolates to eat. So that is the, some people have that idea. The communists have one idea of doing good to the world. Capitalist good world is completely different from that. So it is, everybody feels that this is good to the world. There is nothing like good to the world, but still you try to do good according to your idea to the world, not for the good of the world, but for learning the science of action, the yoga of action, how to do actions. And thus your mind becomes purified. You become calm. That is the outcome of it. Like Swami Vivekananda says there, that the world is like the curly tail of the dog. Never you go on trying to straighten it, it doesn't become straight. That is the nature of that curly tail. That is the nature of the world. Howsoever you try to make the world happy, for thousands and thousands of years, many people have tried to improve the happiness in the world. Has it happened? Great people have strived for that, and that didn't work. The curly tail of the dog, this world, it is crooked. It, again and again it becomes crooked. But still you have to go on making efforts to straighten it, because in that attempt, although the world remains the same, you get straightened, you know. Your mind gets straightened. That is the outcome. And for that you have to do it, just as the equipments in the gymnasium. You lift those things up and down, take the big dumbbells, lift up and down. You are not helping the dumbbells thereby. What are you doing there? you are strengthening. Your shoulders, your arms, your body is becoming strong. You are helping yourselves by lifting the dumbbells. The upliftment is not of the dumbbells, but your upliftment that is important there. So the whole world is like a gymnasium. Look at that from this point of view. And let us work in that spirit, that it is for my benefit that this I am doing. I am helping others so that I get helped. Like you, suppose do the dishes. Take soap and do the dishes and all that. If you are not wearing gloves, many wear gloves for reasons for that, that's okay. But if you are not wearing the gloves and using your hands and all to clean the dishes, afterwards you will see not only the dishes have become cleaned, your hands also have become clean. It is, you are washing the dishes, unconsciously cleaned your hands too. So trying to do good to the world, you will see you become gradually more and more unselfish. Your attachments then start diminishing thereby. You can then have much more peace in life. And each of us will be able to experience that. So, after this has been told, Arjuna has been told that your divinity is covered by this terrible enemy. That enemy has two faces. Two faces. A face which is a pleasant face and an ugly face. A beautiful face and an ugly face. They tell the story of Lincoln. Actually, Abraham Lincoln, in his own this thing, writing, he has written that, and he gave that speech also, that in the election, presidential election, he was accused of having two faces. He was double-faced. So he said, "Do you accuse me of two faces? Had I had another, would I have brought out this one? Why should I be wearing this ugly face had I had another one?" So that is the two faces of our enemy are like this. One is desire. Looks like pleasant. You know, if I have desire, I source my pleasures to desires. That is how the desire looks a very nice thing. We forget that that shrouds our understanding. Desire is pleasant, but it has the other connected face that is called anger. Desire and anger are inseparably connected. There is no way you can ever separate them. You try to hold one, you automatically, even though you don't want it, you hold that also. Many feel anger as a problem. Right from the children, teenagers, the old people, everybody feels anger as a problem. One becomes angry and then say something that one shouldn't have said, just disturbs things unnecessarily. You know that it is all foolishness. The fellow got so angry that broke the TV because saw something, you know, his favorite team lost the match and was watching the TV, got so mad that with a blow he just broke the TV. Now, on what the anger was, what the fellow did later on, of course, he thought that, no, this was not right. Everybody knows that breaking the TV and hurting one's own knuckles, that is the result of it. So, it is not good to get angry. Everybody understands that anger is not right. But what is the why did this anger come to you? What was the cause behind it? You went to fulfill your desire. That desire was there, and that desire had the other face. When you tried to hold the desire, whether you want it or not, you get the other two. One of our Swamis had mentioned that buy one, get other free, you see. That idea we have here, buy one, get the other free. So get desire, the anger comes to you for free, you see. You don't have to make a separate payment for that. You get anger for free. So it is the desire and anger, they are our enemies. And they shroud the knowledge of divinity. We are all essentially, truly divine. We are all really infinite. That is why we strive for infinite. If you closely look at our desires, what we really want, what we strive for, we will be able to see that we really are striving for infinite. If I ask how much happiness do you want, Triveni, Triveni will not be able to put any limit on that. How much? Well, infinite. How much happiness can you? I cannot put a limit on that. Same thing about other things also, which are more grass. Like how much money do you want? Everybody feels a little more than what I am having right now. I am getting, the one who is getting 40,000 feels that if I get 45,000, wow, that I will be able to manage my budget better. Because 45,000 is too little. 50,000 I think I will be able to manage better. And the one who is getting 1 million also feels similarly, you know, that 1 million I have too many things to do, you know, if I get another 50,000 more, then that is better. It's like that. Therefore somebody said, look, that one who is earning 1 million is poorer than the one who is earning 45,000. The one who is earning 1 million is poorer, because his need is 50,000 more, whereas this fellow's need is only 5,000 more. So this fellow is richer because his need is less. So how much do we want? We are craving for infinite. It is in everything like that. So the sages of Vedanta, and everybody in other religions also, we will find the same idea, that it is the infinite, there alone you have the happiness. The infinite you can never find it. Bhuma eva sukham, that is the saying in the Chandogya Upanishad. It's a very beautiful story, I don't want to go deep into it, you know, that how one very highly learned man comes to the teacher. He has learnt everything, all sciences have been learned by him, all arts, sciences, master of everything in a way. But still he says, I am not at peace, I am restless. And the sage tells him that it is what you have learnt is only just the words. You give a name to something, and after you give the name, you feel that you know it. Our knowledge is something like that. And say the knowledge as one thing, then you divide it into branches, give them name. As soon as you give them name, you get a feeling that you have known. This is, instead of just one knowledge, you say there is physics, there is chemistry, there is the biology, there is economics, there is sociology, there is psychology. then you feel you know, because you can utter so many names. Then you further subdivide it, that yes, I know psychology, that is not just enough. Then you have the further names going into it. I know behaviorology, I know psychoanalysis, I know this and this. So many sub-branches you know. Then take one sub-branch again, give nomenclature. Nomenclature is the nature of what we call knowledge. So, that does not really bring satisfaction or peace. So this fellow was suffering in spite of all knowledge. He knew all dance, music, fine arts, paintings, and everything was, he was master of everything, yet said, I am suffering. So he was then given the knowledge by the sage. And one almost ultimate thing that was told to him was, that infinite is happiness. In finite you will never find satisfaction or happiness. So that is our, why we are looking for it, because that is our true nature. Infinite is our true nature, and that is covered by the desires. And thus we now want to therefore get rid of this enemy. And desires make us restless, you see. Without desire, we are at rest. No desire, then no turbulence also, we are at peace. The desire makes us restless. So, therefore, to conquer that is very important, conquer the enemy. So, first he again and again told, know it as enemy. And then told that be practical. It is, you have to have a proper strategy to defeat. Emotionalism won't do. No, emotions are very good. But religion is a practical science, friends. And just not emotional effervescence. It is a lot of emotions. Sri Ramakrishna used to compare that to, you know, that if in a big pan, if there is just a little milk, and if you keep it underneath a big fire is lit, then the milk boils, and since the pot is big, a big bubble gets formed, and it appears, it rises to the top of the pan. And from a distance it may appear, wow, so much of milk, the whole pan is full. When you put out the fire underneath and it cools down, you see there was no milk at all. Little milk was there, whatever little was, that also is now sticking to the sides of the pan, bottom and sides of the pan, nothing is left. So only emotional effervescence like that, all soapy bubbles, you know, that is not going to lead us anywhere in spiritual life. A diligent, persevering practice has to be undertaken with tremendous discipline and strategy. It is not a matter of just a few minutes of just understanding and that's done. It is a long practice. As we progress, we will be able to see that, yes, how much, the life gets changed accordingly. The life, therefore, has to be planned properly for that. And that is what Lord Krishna is telling Arjuna here, that know that your body, sense organs, motor organs, your mind, your intellect, all have been really captured by the desire. They have become the slaves to the desire. They work to fulfill the desire. That is why you cannot now use them to conquer the desires. It is our emotions, they are slaves to the desires. If they go against the desire, if then they immediately they are checked, and the desire starts controlling them. It is therefore we have to be we have to, as I told in the last class, declare them as hostile, as your own witnesses. If they start telling something against you in the court, what first thing is done, your lawyer, your attorney immediately says that they are hostile, they are not our witnesses. So similarly, just declare our sense organs and mind and body and that, you know, as hostile. They are not me. They don't represent me. I am not that. Once you say that, that is a first important good step, first step in the right direction. Now he says, understand that what is superior to what. And here comes really very beautiful understanding of psychology as to how we perceive, how our world gets formed for us. It is the verse that we just recited in the last Friday class, but did not, that is the penultimate verse of the third chapter, and that is the 42nd verse. Indriyani paranyaho indriyebhya param manah manasastu parabuddhi yo buddhe paratastu sah. The senses are said to be superior to their objects. Superior to the senses is the mind, but superior to the mind is the intellect, while that which is superior to the intellect is the self. So let us see how this world kind of captivates us. We become slaves to the world. Who generates this world and how? It is the objects and the body that we perceive. How that perception comes to us? I see my body, I see this microphone, I see all other things. That seeing and hearing and all, that is done by the sensory organs. They generate it. If the organ has becomes different, then this view also becomes different. It is, and what are these organs, these sense organs? They are actually the programs to understand the meaning. The program gives you the meaning. Like, this is a very beautiful science, friends, that suppose a book written in some old script that is not known to many people now, maybe some archaeologist here and there may be able to decipher that, like the those Dead Sea Scrolls. So what is the script? Now it may appear just some kind of pictures, some those pictures, they create, they generate meaning. Those pictures become symbols of some sounds. Those, that sound, it forms a language. If you know what sound it represents, that is the meaning of script. You know, script means a pictorial representation of certain sounds. Like when the letter A is written, it represents a sound. So A, B, C, D, so you get then, like that, then you arrange them, and then when you read C-H-E-T, you say chet, but then the chet means what? That language is to be known, that this is the name, and then a particular person gets connected to it. That is a program, a language. And that language, every sense organ is that language. That it gives meaning to it. A sound is heard. What has happened externally speaking, the diaphragm in the ear has moved because of the vibrations. Now that movement is carried to the brain, and there the sense of hearing, that is the software there, and that decides the meaning. This is here that the Western psychology is very deficient in the understanding of this whole process. That it is not that the movement of neurons that generate the meaning there. That movement of neurons is like the script, like the pictures, the symbols. But of what those are symbols? That is the sense organs. These sense organs are not, eye is not this socket that you see here. This lens is only a receiving instrument. It is a hole from which the signal is captured, that's all. But the real eye is a center in the brain. And it is not really the hardware part of the brain. It is the software that is that deciphers it, that gives meaning to it. And beyond that is again that meaning has to have the connotation. Like somebody hears the word jet and understands it as a name of a person. That much is done. But I know this gentleman as Chet. Our George might be knowing some other Chet. Who knows? So when he hears the sound, some other picture gets generated there. It is how it gets decided. Somebody, hears the same word again about the same person, but the same person doesn't get generated because, somebody looks upon him as a close friend. For somebody, he is an employee. For somebody, he is a close relative. Each of them have a different chat. So each person deciphers this word with a different meaning to it. Now that is how our world gets created. So therefore it is said the sense organs, they are superior. Para means superior. Superior to the gross body because they lend meaning to it. In that sense, from this idea, the sense organs are superior to the gross body. The mind, which combines all these sense inputs, different sense inputs are combined by the mind to get a correlated, a combined meaning. Like I see Chet, eyes have brought that. I hear his voice, that if it is there is no correlation in that, then I will get confused. My eyes may give me a sense of distance, that this microphone is at this distance. So when I move my hand, my touch sense corroborates it. When somebody gets an eye disease, some problem like cataract, then the distances are not perceived clearly. Depths and distances and angles are not perceived clearly. So your touch sense and the sense of vision, they do not agree. And thus you see, you feel that the object is somewhere else where your touch sense doesn't feel it, and so you get confused. Then a readjustment takes place. It doesn't just stop there. The big problem that people do not try to correct their vision is gradually your other senses, they act in such a way that they start confirming with this. And then again, a harmony is created. What does it show is that there is a something that controls this mind too, that puts together all these inputs and creates a correlated picture. That faculty is superior even to the mind, and that is called intellect, the faculty of deciding right and wrong. The sense of correct and incorrect, that is decided by this faculty of intellect. So, these faculties, all these together, they form our instrument of perception. The external body, the sense organs, the mind, and then the intellect. They together create our world view. They are our instruments. I am the governor of that. So, I am superior to them. I am the user of those instruments. I am not controlled by them, but I control them. So, they should work for my benefit. I should not be slave to them. Sometimes that is what happens because of the technology. That how, what will happen if the computers are not working. Such a panic, you know, that Y2K problem just around the corner of the, this 1900s were ending, and in United States it was a panic situation that what will happen. There were pictures that the gas stations will not give gas, the banks will stop, everything, the grocery stores will stop. In one issue of Time, they had shown a man, because of this panic, has filled his basement with supplies that he thought will last for 1 year. Huge barrels of gasoline, you know, have it been filled. They all canned food and all, because he said nothing will be available after that. Now, we should just stop and think, did computer create us or we created the computer? Whether the tail wags the dog or dog wags the tail. It was that phenomena, you know, it appears humorous, but that was all. It was very much real then. So many, computer, a little bit understanding of computer science and all, they got jobs there at that time to solve this problem. It was joke, the joke was like that, if you can spell the word computer, then you have a job now. Because people thought that has to be solved urgently. Because otherwise everything is going to go haywire. We forgot that, do we make computers or computers make us? It is we who make that. It is, we are the controllers of that. We get into this thing that what will happen now. Somebody was telling me the other day that, we now have forgotten the days when email was not there. Not too long ago, you know. Not too long ago. Now we feel what will happen if there is no email. Nothing will happen. What we used to do 30 years back, same thing will happen. Were we not alive 30 years back? 30 years back also people were alive. So same thing will be like that. Nothing will be. We are the governors. We are the masters. They do not control us, we control them. That understanding is to be developed. Then only this enemy of desire can be conquered. We have to take stand on our self-effulgent nature. Let us be confident of that I am the master, I am divine. All power is in me. That conviction That is told in the next, the last verse of this chapter. Evam buddhe param buddhva samsthabhyatmanam atmana jahi shatrum mahabaho kamarupam durasadam. Thus knowing that which is beyond the intellect and controlling the mind by the intellect, kill, O mighty armed one, Arjuna, the enemy in the form of desire, which is difficult to conquer. Desire is so difficult to conquer, but if we take stand on our divine nature, then we will be able to conquer it. It is only then it is possible. Our enemy otherwise has far more stronger and bigger weaponry, like the intellect and organs and all that. We will not be able to defeat it. It is only possible and is certainly possible when we take the stand on our divine nature, that I am divine. And the desires, I am perfect. And why do perfect cannot have desires? I don't need anything. It is only the ignorance that is causing this problem. So therefore, let us take stand on this self. That is the solution. It is, if we do it, we will see gradually the scene starts changing. Therefore, Swami Vivekananda was never tired of telling that first have this self-confidence. The other things will come later. Have this self-confidence. Don't place confidence in some instruments. Those instruments are subject to me. I am not subject to those instruments. Put confidence in you that yes, I can do this. I am happy by nature. No acquisitions are ever going to make me happy. It is just as no burden kept on my head is going to make me feel lighter. Similarly, we don't consider, it is considered foolish that if you are having 50 pounds of weight on your head, and if you are feeling, oh, too much, and what do you do to enlighten you, feel better? You get another 100 pounds and put on that. That is how our acquisition goes on increasing, you know, that this is not enough for me, let me get more. Put more weight, get more encumbered, lose more peace, and feel that, it is certainly not the best way, it is the way to defeat us. So know that my nature is itself blissful. If you observe correctly, you will see that all happiness actually comes from you. Nothing makes you happy. It is you who bring happiness to them. It is you who make the world there. You see the world. When you sleep, the world is not there for you. You, with your rising, the world rises. It is with your sleeping, the world also sleeps. That is, doesn't exist for you. The only real existence that you can stand on is I am. That never leaves you. Other things, they are and they are not, depends on perception. But your perception of I am is not brought to you by any sense organ. Do you see I, your I? Have you ever seen your I? You have never seen it. Have you ever heard it making noise? You have never heard it. You have not touched it. You have not tasted it. And yet, what in the world that you are more sure of than I am? So, take a firm stand on this divine nature. And that is what Lord Krishna tells Arjuna, and through Arjuna all of us have that self-confidence, and then you will see you conquer this enemy of desire and thus attain to the highest. You live then the life of a master rather than the life of the slave to the world. So this ends the third chapter. We will begin the fourth chapter from the next class. Any questions? Yes, George?
I seem to be troubled with two I ams. In other words, the I am the ego and the I am the true I am.
That is true.
And they always get screwed up.
They get screwed up, you are right. They get screwed up. When the word I is used for ego, it is a false statement, because it is still something that is perceived and not the perceiver. When you say I am ego, when you refer to ego as I am, then just as you are referring to this body, I am. It is you are perceiving it like this head, I am. When you say that, George, when you say I am at Vedanta Society, you are referring to the body, that body is there for a part. Body was there all the time when you entered the hall. Till now, the body is there. The mind was not probably there all this 1 hour. For a time it must have thought about what's happening at my home and what they are doing and all that stuff. So it is